Across 100 plus episodes, there have been a few updates. In today's special update episode, we'll look at 10 cases which received updates in the past year. In some of these cases, the updates have resulted in arrests. In others, there have been the development of new leads, renewed investigations, and new evidence. In today's episode, we'll discuss updates from episodes 1, The Mysterious Death of Kurt Sova, 15, The Unexplained Death of Andrew Sadek, 16, The Shocking Murder of Candace Hiltz, 29, The Disappearance of Teresa Lynn Butler, 33, The Disappearance of Heather Elvis, 37, The Disappearance of Danielle Stislicki, 52, The Murder of Irina Yarmolenko, 75, The Disappearance of Christian Ferguson, and we'll have two short updates regarding episodes 55 and 64, The Disappearance of Diamond and Tianda Bradley, and The Disappearance of Rachel Cook. This is Trace Evidence, Case Updates. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we're going to review updates regarding cases previously covered on Trace Evidence. In each update, I'll give you a summary of the case and then go into new developments. So, let's get right to it and go to the first case we're going to be reviewing today, which is The Mysterious Death of Kurt Sova, episodes number 1 and 40 of Trace Evidence. In the first episode of Trace Evidence, I examined the death of Kurt Sova, a 17-year-old who disappeared for 5 days and then was found deceased in a ravine in Newburgh Heights, Ohio. I revisited Kurt's case in episode 40, including much more information which I hadn't discovered during the research for episode 1. On Friday, October 23, 1981, Kurt skipped his day at school and later in the night attended a party with a friend. The party was held in a duplex, and many of the attendees were strangers to Kurt, and older as well. According to Kurt's friend, Kurt had been drinking heavily and wasn't feeling well, so he took him outside to get some fresh air. His friend went back into the duplex to get their coats, and when he returned, Kurt was gone. 5 days later, Kurt's body was found in a ravine just 500 feet from the location of the party, but Kurt's father had searched that area days earlier, and there had been no signs of his son. Strangely, when Kurt was examined, his cause of death was listed as instantaneous physiological death. There was still alcohol in his system, and even more strangely, it was determined that he had been dead for between 24 and 36 hours. If that's true, then the question remains, where was Kurt for the other 3.5 to 4 days that he had been missing? For the rest of their lives, Kurt's parents fought to find him. They alleged they had been threatened and told to stop asking questions. However, both passed away, and now, nearly 40 years later, the truth of what happened to Kurt remains unsolved. In late 2019, local media reported that the Newburgh Heights Police Department's cold case unit were partnering with Tiffin University students to re-examine the case and, hopefully, shine new light on the mystery which haunts his family to this day. Kurt's brother, Kevin, told reporters at a press conference, quote, "He was just a great kid. He had many friends. We just want to know the truth about what happened to my brother," end quote. Due to a lack of evidence, Kurt's case has never been listed as a homicide. However, Police Chief John Majoy is determined to get to the truth. There was no evidence of physical trauma, and so Kurt's death is being investigated as a suspicious death. Around the same time this case was being looked at again, CrimeCon announced that in February of 2020, they would hold a CrowdSolve event in which experts would speak to attendees about the case, present them with evidence, and then the attendees would help examine the case in hopes of determining what happened. While there have been no major updates to Kurt's case, digging back into the case is just the beginning. Many witnesses and people who knew Kurt have since forgotten details, and over 40 years, it's become difficult to figure out exactly what happened. There is hope, though, that Kurt's case is now receiving more attention, and after all this time, someone may be ready to talk. Any update regarding this will be pending in the future. Second case update: The Unexplained Death of Andrew Sadek, episode number 15 of Trace Evidence. 20-year-old Andrew Sadek was a student attending the North Dakota State College of Science in 2014. A bright student with big plans for the future, Andrew found himself on the wrong side of the law when he was arrested for selling $80 worth of marijuana to a drug informant operating on campus. Andrew was given a choice: face felony charges for distribution of drugs, or work for the police as a confidential informant to help catch bigger dealers and buyers. Unsure of what to do, the 20-year-old agreed. However, shortly after agreeing to work for the police, Andrew disappeared. Security camera footage at his school showed Andrew leaving his dorm at 2 a.m. wearing a Tampa Bay Buccaneers hoodie and carrying a black backpack. It would take 2 months for Andrew to be found, and when he was, the circumstances were beyond bizarre. A police dive team performing a routine training exercise in the Red River near Breckenridge, Minnesota, came upon Andrew's body. The 20-year-old had died of a gunshot wound, though the weapon was not found despite additional searches. At the time, it couldn't be determined whether or not the shot had been self-inflicted. Perhaps more bizarrely, however, was that Andrew's Tampa Bay hoodie was not on his body. He was wearing a jacket no one recognized, and the backpack he wore had been filled with rocks. Andrew's wallet was also missing. While Andrew's family argued that the case had been poorly investigated, dismissing Andrew's death as a suicide, authorities claimed to have done a thorough investigation. A gun of the same caliber used to kill Andrew was missing from the family home, though his parents argued he had no history of depression, left no note, and was just 2 weeks shy of graduation. It was their belief he would not have taken his own life. Fighting for justice, Andrew's family were heavily involved in the drafting of Andrew's Law, which afforded more rights to confidential informants. Two years after Andrew's death, his family filed a lawsuit against Richland County and its sheriff, Jason Weber. The lawsuit argued that not only had law enforcement failed to train Andrew or offer protection during his work as a confidential informant, but that they had also lied about the potential charges and legal repercussions for his arrest. Weber's lawyer argued that the Sadeks had been very vocal in the media and requested the judge issue a gag order, though ultimately the judge dismissed that motion. In April of 2018, the Sadeks lawyer requested a postponement since neither Andrew's school nor the investigating agencies had provided them with the evidence and files they had requested. That motion was granted. In July of 2019, the Sadeks' wrongful death suit was dismissed. Southeast District Judge Jay Schmitz explained his decision, writing in part, quote, "One can only speculate almost endlessly. Was Andrew's death a suicide or homicide? If it was homicide, who did it? What was the killer or killer's motivation? Was Andrew killed during a drug deal? If so, was it related to his role as a confidential informant?" End quote. As of this time, the North Dakota Supreme Court is reviewing the judge's decision to dismiss the case, though no formal decision has yet been determined. A lawyer for the defense, Corey Quinton, told the media, quote, "The undisputed facts of this case are that we will likely never know what, when, where, how, or why," end quote. For the Sadeks, they want justice for their son and an admission that the situation was handled improperly, which may have led to the death of Andrew. Should the Supreme Court reverse the dismissal, the case would be sent to district court. Police say the investigation remains open and active. Update case number 3, the shocking murder of Candace Hiltz, Trace Evidence episode 16. 17-year-old Candace Hiltz had been a child prodigy. Performing complex math by the age of 11, she had a bright future and hoped to get involved in law, with her ultimate goal to become a Supreme Court justice. Unfortunately, Candace was murdered on August 15th, 2006. In the weeks leading up to her death, Candace had clashed with the Fremont County Sheriff's Department in regard to their pursuit of her brother about a trespassing complaint. Her brother, James, suffers from multiple psychological issues. During the discussion, Candace didn't like the way the deputy was speaking to her family and made it clear that she wanted him to leave. The deputy threatened to arrest Candace, who responded that he should, and she'd be happy to tell the authorities all about how she'd seen him accepting envelopes from local drug dealers. A few days later, the Hiltz family dog vanished from the property. When Candace went to report it to the sheriff's department, she got into an argument with Deputy Robert Dodd. While it was possible the dog had been attacked by an animal, the family lived in a remote area. They also felt that there was something suspicious about it. On August 15th, Candace's mother left the family home, where Candace and her 11-month-old daughter remained. On her return several hours later, she found a disturbing scene. Candace's daughter, Paige, was screaming in her crib. When she looked around the rest of the house, she found blood spatter and pools of blood on the floor. Under a bed, wrapped in a green comforter, she found Candace's body. She had been shot multiple times, predominantly in the head. Deputies Briscoe and Dodd were put in charge of the investigation. According to Candace's family, the investigation was done poorly, the crime scene was hardly examined, and multiple pieces of evidence were left behind, including shotgun shells, bloody towels, the green comforter, and Candace's shirt. Deputies chose to focus on Candace's brother and seemed to focus only on him, dismissing alternative theories. Days after Candace's murder, the family dog was found. It had been tied to a tree and butchered with an axe. When the official autopsy report was released, there were multiple errors. The report claimed Candace's boyfriend had found her, but her mother had actually done so, and Candace didn't have a boyfriend. In addition to that, it reported that three guns had been used in the murder, though shells had only been found from two guns. In December of 2016, a local man paid $50 to purchase an abandoned storage unit. Quickly upon entering, he realized something was wrong. Among many items related to law enforcement, there was a bloody axe and a pair of bloody socks. It was later determined to have been evidence connected to Candace's case. Eventually, it came out that the storage unit had previously belonged to Deputy Robert Dodd. Dodd was placed on administrative leave, and 5 months later, Deputy Dodd retired from the sheriff's department. In June of 2018, Robert Dodd was arrested and charged with one misdemeanor count of abuse of public records and two counts of official misconduct related to the evidence found in the storage unit. Dodd was found guilty by a jury and sentenced to 180 days on the misdemeanor charge, with 165 of those days suspended. He received a $500 fine for the misdemeanor, as well as two $250 fines for the other offenses. According to the trial, the evidence had sat in a locker in his office for a year because he claimed he wanted to take more photos and write a more comprehensive report. When he moved offices, he brought the evidence home and then later put it in the storage unit. Dodd filed an appeal after his convictions, and in May of 2019, his appeal was dismissed and the charges upheld. District Attorney Molly Chilson, who was involved in Dodd's prosecution, spoke to the press after the appeal was dismissed, saying, quote, "The defendant argues upholding his convictions would result in a parade of horribles, a slippery slope, whereby any peace officer could be prosecuted for a good faith mistake in the course of his duty. That is not what this case is about. This is about the defendant and his grave and criminal departure from the duties of his office, his abuse of the public trust, and his efforts to conceal his misconduct by abusing the public record." End quote. While Dodd's convictions give some comfort to Candace's family, they believe Dodd should have been given more time and larger penalties. Sadly, there are bigger questions that remain to be answered, and it's the belief of many that the identity of Candace's killer may be attached to someone working for the sheriff's department at the time of her death. Candace's case remains open, though as the release of this update, her brother remains the only named suspect to date, despite no evidence to connect him to the crime. Case update number 4, the disappearance of Teresa Lynn Butler, Trace Evidence Episode 29. On January 24th, 2006, Gary Butler was working the night shift. During a shift, he placed a call home to speak with his wife, Teresa, but received no answer. When he arrived home the next morning at approximately 10 a.m., he could find no trace of his wife, who had apparently disappeared from their home, leaving their two children behind with no one to look out for them. Several items were missing from the home, including a video camera, PlayStation and several games, Nintendo GameCube, Maglite flashlight, digital camera, and the car stereo had been removed from Teresa's Jeep. Teresa's purse was missing, but strangely, her wedding rings and jacket were left behind. Her rings were found beneath the couch, which many consider odd as she only took off her rings right before bed. Investigation revealed several other inconsistencies. A call had been made from Teresa's cell phone at approximately 3:16 a.m. the night she vanished. This call was made to a man in Gideon, Missouri, who claimed to have no knowledge who Teresa was. Another call was made after Teresa had been reported missing, this time to the home of two elderly women in Clarkton, Missouri, who also did not know Teresa. Police later received a call from a man who said that the family video camera had been involved in a drug purchase less than 24 hours after she vanished. Police recovered the camera, but could not conclusively prove that it belonged to her. For the most part, Teresa's case went cold until November of 2019. Melvin Ray Hufford, a person of interest in Teresa's case from early on, was arrested in November of 2019, charged with first-degree involuntary manslaughter and tampering with physical evidence in a felony prosecution. New Madrid County Sheriff Terry Stevens told the press, quote, "It is satisfying to file charges in the case, but our initial goal was to bring Teresa home safely. That isn't going to happen, so we can at least know that we have someone charged and there is some accountability for her death," end quote. Hufford confessed to authorities, describing what had happened the night Teresa vanished. According to his story, he, Teresa, and a third man were doing methamphetamine together. Hufford claims that after injecting himself and Teresa with meth, that she began to complain of chest pains. Hufford went on to explain that he went to get Teresa a glass of water, and by the time he returned, she was unconscious and non-responsive. Hufford checked her pulse, and there was none, at which point he and the other male became frightened. Hufford alleged that after this, he wrapped Teresa in a tarp and took her out of her home. To cover up their trail, he and the other man began taking random items from the home to make it look like a robbery. Hufford said that he took Teresa's body, placed it in the abandoned home of his father, and left it there for several years while he went away to prison for unrelated crimes. At some point, Hufford wrote to his father and asked him about the body in the home. Hufford's father later confirmed that he had in fact seen Teresa's remains. After being released, Hufford went back to the home and recovered Teresa's remains, at which time he placed them in a pit and set them ablaze. After the fire was out, he crushed the bones and placed them in a bucket, dumping them in a ditch. Police did locate and speak to the second man that Hufford claimed was present at the time, though authorities do not believe the man was there and think Hufford was trying to buy himself a deal. Ultimately, Hufford faced charges alone. Hufford pled guilty and was sentenced to 7 years for the Class C felony of manslaughter for injecting the fatal dose of meth and 3 years for a Class D felony for tampering with evidence for moving her body. In total, Hufford will spend 10 years in prison. Sheriff Stevens later commented, quote, "I'm somewhat disappointed in the amount of time he received, but I understand that was the best we were going to get, so I'm satisfied with it," end quote. While Teresa's case has been apparently closed following Hufford's incarceration, her family is left without a body to bury or mourn. There are still some, though, who believe there's more to the story than what Hufford confessed to. Perhaps we will find out someday. Case update number 5, the disappearance of Heather Elvis, trace evidence episode number 33. On December 17th, 2013, 20-year-old Heather Elvis went out on a date. After her date dropped her off at approximately 1:15 a.m., she disappeared. Investigations would later show that Heather received a call from a payphone from her former boyfriend, Sidney Moore. Heather had carried on an affair with the married Moore, 38 at the time. After Moore's wife discovered the affair, Sidney cut off contact with Heather, though his wife Tammy would text and call Heather, harassing and threatening her. After receiving the call from Moore, Heather called her roommate explaining that he wanted to meet up. The roommate advised Heather not to go. This call lasted approximately 2 minutes, and Heather was never heard from again. After being reported missing, 2 days passed before investigators found Heather's car. It was parked sideways at the Peachtree Landing boat launch. While the car was locked, none of her missing belongings, her purse, keys, or phone, were located. Despite searches of the water and the land around it, no trace of Heather was found. Cell phone records allowed police to follow Heather's movements the night she disappeared, but all records stopped at 3:41 a.m. While Sidney and Tammy denied any contact with Heather, surveillance footage showed that Sidney had in fact called Heather the night she disappeared. Traffic cameras also captured an image of a truck, the same style and color of the truck Sidney drove, heading to and from the area of the boat launch that night between 3:36 and 3:46 a.m. There was a great deal of suspicion cast on the Moorers, though for a time, law enforcement was unable to gather enough evidence to make charges. On February 21st, though, investigators served a warrant to search their property. At the conclusion of that search, both Sidney and Tammy were arrested and charged with kidnapping, murder, obstruction of justice, and indecent exposure. While the murder charges were dropped, Sidney went on trial in relation to the kidnapping charges. The jury was hung, unable to come to a unanimous decision, which resulted in a mistrial. Sidney eventually went back to court, this time being charged with obstruction of justice related to the lies he had told investigators about his whereabouts and the phone calls from the night Heather vanished. After a 3-day trial, Sidney was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. In April of 2018, both Tammy and Sidney were indicted on charges of kidnapping by a grand jury. Tammy was ultimately sentenced to 30 years in prison. Sidney received the same sentence when he was found guilty in 2019. Both Tammy and Sidney, under South Carolina law, were given 1 year to turn over information related to the location of Heather's remains, which would result in a reduction of their sentences. While Tammy's year has since expired, Sidney has until September 18th, 2020, to produce this information. Sidney has yet to come forward with any information about Heather, her death, or her whereabouts. While the Elvis family finds comfort in the convictions, they long to know what happened to their daughter and to have the opportunity to lay her to rest. Tammy and Sidney continue to maintain that they are innocent and played no role in Heather's disappearance. Case update number 6, the disappearance of Danielle Stislicki, trace evidence episode number 37. On December 2nd, 2016, 28-year-old Danielle Stislicki made plans to have dinner with her best friend, Sarah. Danielle was working for MetLife, an insurance company in Southfield, Michigan. Danielle asked to leave early and exited the building at approximately 5 p.m. Around that same time, Sarah received a text from Danielle's phone explaining that she needed to stop home and then would meet her for dinner. Danielle, though, never arrived. When Sarah still hadn't heard from Danielle the next day, she went over to her apartment but received no answer at the door. She called Danielle's parents and they came over, finding the scene strange. Danielle's Jeep was parked 8 feet from her door. Her purse was left inside. When her parents entered the apartment, they found everything was in order except Danielle's keys and cell phone were missing. Police were called and began trying to find evidence, though there was little to gather. Rewards were offered for information regarding Danielle's whereabouts, but in the end, police were left to conclude Danielle had been the victim of a crime. Eventually, a witness came forward claiming to have seen Danielle speaking to the security guard for her office building in the parking garage the day she vanished. 30-year-old Floyd Galloway was that security guard. Curiously, he was not scheduled to work that night. It was suspected by Danielle's mother, who worked with her, that Galloway had a crush on her daughter. When police went to speak with Galloway, he retained a lawyer and refused to speak with investigators. Eventually, police got a warrant and searched Galloway's home 3 times, removing a mattress, car, and floorboards. Later, while speaking to Galloway's sister-in-law, investigators revealed that a witness had seen Danielle at Galloway's home the night she disappeared. On June 28, 2017, Galloway was arrested and charged in connection to an attack which had taken place in Hines Park in September of 2016, 3 months prior to Danielle's disappearance. Less than a month after arresting Galloway, police executed a massive search of Hines Park looking for any signs of Danielle, believing he had been involved in her disappearance. Ultimately, nothing was found. Police then searched Galloway's home and found it had been cleaned out. They spoke with his wife, who provided them with items they had been looking for in connection to the Hines Park attack and a second attack. Galloway was convicted and sentenced to serve 16 to 35 years. While incarcerated, police elevated Galloway's status from person of interest to suspect in Danielle's case. Ultimately, Galloway has been charged with first-degree murder, a felony which carries a life sentence. Galloway has pled not guilty. Michigan Assistant Attorney General Jamie Horowitz is prosecuting the case and has stated that they have an abundance of evidence, including witness statements, GPS from Danielle's phone showing her at Galloway's house, and DNA evidence from carpet in his home and his van. Judge James Brad agreed and directed the case to circuit court. In a preliminary hearing, Sarah, Danielle's mother Anna, and 2 of her co-workers testified. One co-worker explained that she had seen Galloway with the hood of his car up, apparently experiencing car trouble, and Danielle was walking towards him. Another co-worker testified that he saw Danielle drive out of the parking garage with Galloway in her passenger seat. A detective who originally questioned Galloway testified, quote, "His demeanor was kind of standoffish. He wouldn't look at us. Kind of stared off at the wall when we were talking to him. His hands were shaking," end quote. Police revealed that they had recovered Danielle's car keys and Fitbit near an M5 entrance ramp between Danielle's apartment and a Tim Hortons restaurant where Galloway was caught on surveillance footage at 8:38 p.m. the night Danielle disappeared. Footage also showed Galloway using the store's phone, then being picked up by a cab. The cab driver dropped Galloway off at an apartment complex directly across from the parking garage Danielle had allegedly driven him out of earlier that night. Police believe Galloway got a ride from Danielle after feigning car trouble. She brought him to his house where the crime took place. He then drove her Jeep back to his apartment, walked from the apartment to Tim Hortons, and took a cab back to pick up his car. A Michigan State forensics biologist testified that touch DNA connected to Danielle was found on carpet taken from the Galloway home. The forensic examiner said that, based on the lack of blood, he believed the cause of death was strangulation. It was decided that there was enough evidence to move forward with trial. The trial itself was delayed and is set to begin on April 20th, that being this coming Monday. More updates are pending regarding how the trial will turn out. Despite all of the evidence, Galloway maintains his innocence and has disregarded pleas from the family for the location of Danielle's remains. Experts believe Galloway will not reveal the location of her remains during the trial, and even if convicted, will likely not give up the information unless there's something in it for him. We can only hope that the Stislicki family will receive justice and hopefully the opportunity to lay Danielle to rest. Case update number 7, the murder of Irina Yarmolenko, Trace Evidence episode 52. 20-year-old Irina Yarmolenko was finishing her sophomore semester in May of 2008. Ira was planning to move on to UNC Chapel Hill to pursue a career in public health. However, Ira would never make it to her junior year, losing her life under strange circumstances. On May 5th, 2008, just days after her 20th birthday, Ira attended school to take a final exam. Finishing her exam with a second one planned for 5 p.m., she went out to run errands, but never returned. Surveillance footage followed Ira through some of her errands that day, though when she drove down towards the Catawba River, no one was aware. Not long after, two jet skiers were going down the river and came upon a strange scene. Ira's body was lying beside her car, which had impacted a tree stump, though not at a high rate of speed. When investigators arrived, they found the 20-year-old with three ligatures around her neck. It was ruled that she had died as the result of asphyxia secondary to strangulation. On the same day they found Ira, investigators spoke with Mark Carver, who had been fishing not far from the scene of the crime. Detectives became suspicious when Carver claimed not to have heard anything, and they believed that someone that close to the crime would have heard the car, if nothing else. 7 months later, Carver and his cousin Neil Cassida were arrested and charged with conspiracy and murder. Cassida would die before the trial, leaving Carver to be charged alone. However, it took prosecutors another 2 years to finally bring him to trial. This was due in part to the fragility of the evidence using technology which was new at the time. Carver's guilt was also alleged due to touch DNA, found in three locations on the victim's car, though it was also mixed with touch DNA from investigators who had shaken hands with Carver earlier in the day. There were many questions about the evidence used against Carver, including but not limited to improper collection of evidence, contamination of the crime scene, and the fact that investigators focused on Carver from day one, never really looking at any other potential angles. Things were complicated even further by the fact that Carver had a limited education, was illiterate, and had trouble understanding questions investigators asked. Another issue with the case was that at least one other person had confessed to the murder, but then later recanted. In addition to this, investigators told the Yarmolenko family that someone was in Irina's car when she drove to the river, but this never came up during the trial. There were also questions about the manner of Ira's death and the possibility of suicide. During the trial, Carver's defense attorneys called no witnesses, nor did they present any evidence. Carver was ultimately found guilty, but shortly after, his case was taken on by Chris Mumma, a lawyer for the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence. Mumma battled against prosecutor Locke Bell about evidence, his failure to deliver files, and the holes in the trial. As of the original episode release, Mumma was fighting to get Carver a new trial. In April of 2019, an evidentiary hearing took place in which witnesses testified about Carver's mental and physical disabilities. Others testified about mistakes made during the investigation, and at least one juror from Carver's previous trial filed an affidavit to recant his guilty vote. A DNA expert testified that the evidence used to convict Carver was of low-quality samples and would not qualify as a match today. Police Captain Scott Wright testified about a second suspect who was reported to have been seen in the area the day Ira died, though this evidence was not provided to the defense during the first trial. On June 5, 2019, Judge Christopher Bragg, following consideration of the evidentiary hearing, made the decision to set aside Carver's conviction and grant him a new trial. This decision was made based around bad representation by Carver's lawyers in the original trial, as well as problems with the touch DNA evidence. District Attorney Locke Bell told the media he would file an appeal and that, if necessary, he would prosecute the case again. 6 days later, on June 11th, Carver was released from jail with $100,000 bail, which was paid for by the NCCAI. Carver received GPS monitoring instead of house arrest, allowing him to move freely through the state of North Carolina while being monitored. On July 5th, 2019, Locke Bell filed his official notice to appeal. This is the last development in the case, with the new trial pending following a decision of Bell's appeal, which has not yet been filed. Case update number 8, the disappearance of Christian Ferguson, Trace Evidence episode number 75. This was one of the most disturbing, upsetting, and incredibly difficult to confront cases ever covered on Trace Evidence. This is the case of Christian Ferguson, a 9-year-old who vanished from his father's custody in 2003. Christian was born with a life-threatening illness and nearly died when he was just 3 days old. This illness resulted in Christian needing constant monitoring while also needing to be given a specific diet. Christian's parents divorced and his father, Dewan, was granted full custody, with his mother, Theta, only having visitation rights. In 2001, Christian experienced a health setback requiring full-time supervision and care from nurses who would come to the home during the week. Several of these nurses reported poor conditions and mistreatment of the child, but nothing was done. Theta took Dewan to court, alleging he was denying her visitation rights, and on June 14th, the judge ordered that Dewan comply with the court order and grant Theta visitation, but Christian would vanish before she could ever see him. On June 11th, 2003, Dewan called 911 claiming his car had been stolen while Christian was inside. Dewan alleged he had stopped to call the hospital to notify them that he was rushing Christian in due to a decline in his health. Investigators had many questions about the day Christian vanished, Dewan's story, and over the course of the next 6 years, they discovered many instances, witness statements, and evidence supporting claims that Christian had been neglected and abused. The search for Christian raised many questions, from Dewan's vehicle being found hours after allegedly being stolen, with nothing missing aside from Christian, despite the presence of many valuable pieces of electronics in the vehicle, which was found parked on a neighborhood street not far from a friend of Dewan's. There were also sightings of this friend's vehicle within the proximity of where Dewan alleged his vehicle was stolen. Honestly, the details of this case are highly disturbing and extensive. I'd recommend listening to episode 75 to hear the full, horrifying story. For many, Dewan was the main person of interest in his son's disappearance, and statements from other family members drew a lot of attention to his behaviors on the morning Christian went missing. 16 years after Christian's disappearance, in October of 2019, St. Louis County arrested and charged his father, Dewan, with one count of first-degree murder. He is currently being held without bond. While the details of what resulted in Dewan being charged haven't yet been revealed, I would argue there's a good chance it has to do with the fact that his wife, who he was married to during the time Christian disappeared, filed for divorce 1 month prior to Dewan being charged. When asked about the arrest, Theta told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, quote, "I knew that justice was on its way, but I'm in shock. I feel supported and I'm excited. I'm a lot of different things right now because I don't know how to be in this place, but I'm glad I'm here." End quote. Theta has long fought for justice for her son and has been very involved in victim advocacy. As of now, Dewan Ferguson is in prison and awaiting trial. His defense attorney has argued that he'll get the case thrown out, but only time will tell what new developments in this extremely sad and disturbing case will be revealed. Unlike the previous cases, these final two have short updates, but I did want to include them in the interest of thoroughness. Case update number 9, the disappearance of Diamond and Tionda Bradley, Trace Evidence episode number 55. In 2001, sisters Diamond and Tionda Bradley vanished from their Chicago home. A lot of questions and suspicions revolve around two men in the children's lives, though no solid evidence has ever been revealed to the public, and nearly 20 years later, the two remain missing. In May of 2019, a Texas woman emerged claiming to be Tionda Bradley. The woman began texting a family member claiming that she had been abducted by a family friend. However, while the texter knew some pertinent details, she lacked a scar that Tionda was known to have. The family hired a private investigator to determine what the truth was. In late May, the Bradley family released a statement that the woman claiming to be Tionda was lying. In part, T Tionda and Diamond's great aunt, Sheila Bradley Clark, told CBS News, quote, "Unfortunately, the information provided on social media from this group of scammers are not the missing Diamond or Tionda Bradley," end quote. Unfortunately, the sisters remain missing and there have been no major developments in the case over the past 19 years. Case update number 10, the disappearance of Rachel Cook, trace evidence episode number 64. 19-year-old Rachel Cook returned home to Georgetown, Texas to spend the 2001 holiday season with her family. Rachel decided to stay a little longer to attend a relative's wedding, but everything went bad on January 10, 2002. Rachel went out for her morning run, but never returned. Over the course of the past 19 years, investigators have worked the case in hopes of finding Rachel and or those responsible for her disappearance. In 2019, there was an apparent break in the case. A vehicle was delivered to detectives working for the Georgetown and Williamson County investigators working Rachel's case. In the days after Rachel's disappearance, detectives announced they were seeking a white Trans Am in connection to the crime. The car delivered to police was a white Trans Am out of Dallas and is currently being swept for DNA or evidence connected to Rachel's disappearance. In addition to the receipt of the car, authorities released two new sketches of persons of interest in the 19-year-old's disappearance. Police released the sketches and informed the public that a $100,000 reward is available for information regarding Rachel's disappearance. Jessica Cox, a detective with Williamson County, told the media, quote, "Several months ago, the cold case unit, along with our partners at the FBI and our forensic artist Natalie Murray, began to recreate the original drawings that were done. So she sat down, re-interviewed the original witnesses, and she was able to come up with new digital sketches of the suspects," end quote. There has been no news recently regarding the case since 2019 and what, if any, evidence investigators have gathered from the vehicle, but hopefully the case is being worked harder and new developments will come. Those are the 10 cases in which there have been updates over the past year. I'm hopeful that we'll receive more updates in the future, and I'll be watching these cases along with all others closely. In regard to the Irina Yarmolenko update about Mark Carver getting a new trial, the trial will be held just a few hours from where I live, so I'm hoping to attend the trial and give you more updates with what's happening. Before closing out this special update episode, I wanted to, as always, thank our amazing Patreon producers for their support. Special thanks to Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Gerald Lopez Barbosa, Jessica Shannon, Jessica Yunt, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Robbie Blue, Roberta Jansen, Samantha Ford, Stephanie Segrist, Tara Doble, Tom Archer, Tracy Woods, and Stephen Weiland. If you're interested in becoming a patron for Trace Evidence, you can visit patreon.com/traceevidence for more information. That's going to do it for this update episode. Make sure to follow me on social media at TraceEvPod on Twitter, TraceEvidencePod on Instagram, Trace Evidence Podcast on YouTube, or search Facebook for Trace Evidence Podcast. For questions, comments, case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. All social media links, contact forms, merchandise links, and more are available on the website at trace-evidence.com. I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.